Our next speaker this morning is Tom Hutchinson. He's the manager of new product development at Swanson Industries, and he's going to talk about fluid power generation and transport systems for longwalls. Tom graduated, I'm not going to throw the date out there. I'll just say Tom graduated from Virginia Tech with a mining engineering degree. He's worked in various management engineering positions with coal companies and equipment suppliers, including North American Coal, AEP, and Westphalia Mining Progress. He's been a professional engineer since 1979 and is currently manager of new product development with Swanson Industries in Morgantown, West Virginia. How about a warm welcome for Tom?
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I don't have a whole lot of graphics, but what I wanted to do was go through a brief history of the longwall, just to give you an idea of what, as a supplier of pumps, we're up against. Typically, we've been reactive all these years because we more or less provide what the mining operators and the shield suppliers and so forth request. So, what we're up against is providing adequate volume of fluid to the longwall face. It's an ongoing need, and this need applies to the emulsion and also to the water. The demand for water over the years has greatly increased with the need for cooling and also spray. I'm just going to focus on the emulsion with the idea that the water demand will follow close. A gross deficiency in the supply of the emulsion is easy to recognize. When the shield movements don't keep pace with the shear, everybody starts screaming. So that's real easy to recognize. The real danger, I think, is when the deficiency is marginal. You know, the idea, well, we can get by, or maybe the deficiency is not really noticed. That's when you start getting these potentials for roof problems as one. And it may just sort of creep into the picture without actually low setting pressure of the shields, deterioration of the roof conditions. Low system pressure is a major problem. Okay, now, is it more flow simply a matter of adding pumps? Just add another pump. But don't forget, the pumps are 2,000 to 3,000 feet away from the tailgate. The delivery lines also need to be designed. If not, if you don't put the lines in to complement the pumps, the pressure won't get to where they're needed. I mean, it's as simple as that. Over the years, electric power first the voltage went up, so the cable size went down, but shortly thereafter, the cable sizes went up. The conveyor belt sizes go up. All these are in response to physical and legal standards. So it's a simple matter. Well, we just keep increasing the size. Only thing wrong with that is we're in a mine. And particularly in the eastern United States, the physical size isn't always there. You don't have additional height, you don't have additional width. So what do you do? Once again, I'll just reiterate, since the physical size of hydraulic hoses isn't a statutory requirement, And it's not an absolute value. Sometimes it gets pushed off, and or put off rather. So the hose people or the monorail people, sometimes we get forced into the situation where we use whatever space is left over. I want to present several examples of what is being done to address the need for this additional space. I'm going to show you an example of some modern high-capacity pump stations. I want to show you some innovative monorail designs where we use take more efficient use of the space. And one case or two cases where we actually combine the monorails and the pumps in one system. And I want to wrap it up just to cite one example. It's not within my capabilities, but somewhere out there, there's got to be somebody that can combine the pump controls with the face controls that will make the pumps proactive instead of reactive. So just to see where we're going, we got to look where we've been. Don't want to get bogged down in all this stuff, but if we just review a few things here, we'll see that the demands on the longwall services has tripled in the last 30 years or so. And these numbers aren't absolute, obviously. I'm sure there's exceptions, but basically, the number of longwall faces has gone from 100, and this is the United States, by the way, not worldwide, but the number of faces has dropped from approximately 150 down to 50. The face length, typically in the 80s, might have been 400 to 600 feet. Now it's, we're seeing 1,100 to 1,500 feet faces and sometimes more. The panel lengths were short. Now they're getting longer, and once again, some of them are even longer than that. Production tons per day might have been in the 3,500 ton range. Now we're in the 20,000, and once again, we can go more than that. Belt widths, 36, 42 inch. Now we're looking at 72 inch. Belt speeds, 500. Now they're up around 1,000. Depth of cut, 28 inches. Now we're looking at 1 meter maybe. Power on the face was 995 volts, now it's 4160 is common. Support ratings might have been in the 400 ton range. Now we're looking at, got a spare here, 1200 ton range. Support spacing 1.5 meters, now it's 2 meters. AFC horsepower, that back then we were like 600 horsepower. Now we're up to 5,000, twin 26 chain, now we're at twin 48 or maybe even more. The old fluid couplings, now just about all of them have some kind of soft start capability. Deck plate, 3/4 inch, now they're like maybe 3 inches thick. Did we have bottom plates back then? No, but now all of them have that. 700 millimeter wide face, now it's 1100. Everything's getting bigger, of course. Shear horsepower was 500, now it's maybe 2500. We got shear speeds of over 100 feet a minute, it's possible. The early chainless systems, I think everything's pretty well standard as a rack bar type. I'm not sure of that, but that's my understanding. The little tiny pumps, you might not even had two of them, but you had small pumps. Now we've got some stations have 800 gallon pumps or 440 gallon pumps. One significant thing, electric unloaders are common, and more VFDs on the pump controls. And I'll get into that a little bit later. No monorails back then. Of course, now we all have monorails, as I recall. Pressure hoses. Here's something that's interesting. You might have had one pressure hose and one return hose and one water hose. Now we've got three, sometimes four or more. Just depends on the demand. So all these things are getting hung on the monorail, but we're not making the entries any wider. That's the point I'm trying to make. Just a few comments about that table. Obviously, the width of the entry affects how wide the belt can be. That's one reason the belt speeds have gone faster. In the 80s, we had last remnants of chocks. Then came the caliper shields briefly, and then the lemniscatic link. If you remember back then, probably not many do, but there was a big raging battle. Which is better, two leg or four leg? Yeah, okay. Three strand change, went to twin outboard, and then went through a brief run of single center strand, but now everybody's pretty much twin inboard or midboard or whatever. T discharge was standard. Cross frame quickly took over. There was a few interim versions, including the roller curve and the side discharge. Crushers were not common because if you could get around the T discharge, you didn't need a crusher. Nowadays, with the side discharge, the crusher is pretty well universal. That's probably one of the biggest production improvements, I think, that's come down the pike, is the ability to put a crusher on the face. When the chain haulage for shears was being phased out, there were several attempts to develop chainless haulage. I threw in a comment there. Some of these interim versions were comical when we look at them today, but back in those days, they were serious attempts. The Icotrac, and that's a brand name, I don't mean that, but it's just a type. It's what's in use today as far as I know. Here's the thing. Why did the monorail come into existence? Because regulations prohibited manually handling 1,000-volt systems or above. So when people started coming in with 2,300-volt systems, they had to come up with a way to handle the cables so that a person is not manually. And I made a mistake here. I'm going to admit that. I tried to make a joke. Prior to monorails, cables and hoses might have been dragged along the floor using winch or manpower. However, I said not a violation of the PC rules since no women worked in the mines. That's not true. Actually, in the 80s, there was some women. It was in the 70s when there wasn't any women. All right. So anyway, I wanted to give some examples of modern high-capacity emulsion pump stations. If you remember, I keep saying that, probably you don't. The early pump stations may have been just a pump on a skid, and every cross cut, every breakthrough, they drag it forward and reconnect the hoses. That was a major source of fluid contamination. In some cases, where the space permitted, pumps and tanks were skidded along the belt as a mule train. There's some people in this room I know that use that. Anyway, higher demand, the trend is toward larger pumps. The use of larger pumps brings with it inherent problems. The unloader valve introduces or removes large surges of fluid in near instantaneous time, so you're shock loading the system. Whoops. In some ways, and I'm going to make a stupid example here, but in some ways it would be better to have a bunch of small pumps, like 301-gallon pumps, instead of one 300-gallon pump. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but for smoothness of flow, it's actually better. Obviously, for maintenance reasons, it's not better. So the dilemma for that is solved with the advent of variable frequency drives applied to the emulsion pumps. And both in the hydraulic or the emulsion systems and the water systems, the VFD is the best way to go, and it will be the way of the future if it's not already. Less wasted energy, less turbulence in the reservoir. An unloading pump running at full speed dumps huge amounts of fluid back into the reservoir, and you're creating turbulence. Well, piston pumps or plunger pumps don't like turbulence. And then, of course, you got less shock when you're loading and unloading because you're ramping up from a lower speed ramp. So here's a modern track-mounted pump car. It has two pumps in this case, the unloader, an accumulator, a pressure manifold, and of course there's a boost manifold over there on the other side. Now in this case, this would be one of two pumps that were in the station. You notice that thing there, that's the VFD drive for this particular pump. And in that box, there are two VFDs, one for each of the pumps. And the programming is the secret to good VFD. You get them to ramp up and down instead of loading and unloading. So it really makes a smooth transition to keep pace with the demands. Just brings up a point, where do you mix your emulsion? Some people mix on the surface, some people mix at the station. The fluid control, the quality control is better if you do it at a central station, we think. Anyway, here's a modern track-mounted tank car. There's the car, there's the tank. You got your face returns come in here. You go into through space-saving in-tank filters, arranged so that you can change or service the filters while the pump station's still running if you want. There's your incoming water filter. In this case, it's the emulsion mix. In this case, the fluid is mixed on the surface, but it comes several thousand feet through a pipeline, which gets broken or moved or cut or whatever. So you still need filtration. But you're filtering that emulsion before it gets into the tank. Okay. I already went through that. Okay, and this is just a typical track-mounted pump station. Once again, that's one of two pump cars that would be on this station. What are we going to do now? Oh, okay. Thank you. All right. Okay. We use VFDs to control the emulsion pump, the water pumps. Like I said, the initial cost is offset by operating and maintenance advantages. In addition to the air-cooled version, which we saw earlier, the big box, we've got one here, it's a liquid cooled. It fits neatly within a pump cabinet. And that particular pump cabinet we'll get into a little bit later, but you'll notice the size difference, so there's some advantage to looking at a liquid cooled VFD. Okay, innovative monorail systems. How can you make a monorail innovative? I mean, you know, well, let's see. As mentioned, modern longwall was born of necessity with the advent of plus 1,000 volt power systems. The longwall power centers are getting larger, more difficult to move. So there's an incentive to maximize the power move distance. Making the power move, the monorail longer helps move the power move distances out. How does that play into what we're trying to do? We got wider, faster conveyors, more larger power cables, all within an entry that cannot be increased in size. We continue to squeeze the space left over for hydraulic hoses. Now we want to make the monorail longer. Doesn't that go against what we're trying to do? Yes, but there's a challenge there, and we can answer the challenge. A side-by-side monorail, it's been around for quite a few years, but basically you put your cables on one rail and you got your pipes on the other rail. The hoses are replaced by the use of pipes. There's an advantage in the friction factor of pipes over hoses, but the biggest advantage is that the pipes are more compact than hoses. The disadvantage is you got to handle two sets of rails. Nevertheless, it addresses the problem of pressure loss, and there's quite a few systems like that running. An over and under monorail is another way to look at it. The pipes and cables are carried on a separate rail, but the cable trolleys are riding on a rail that's underneath the pipe rail. Once the cable rail's been installed, you don't have to rehandle it anymore. So that's an advantage. There's a system there. You'll see the pipe trolleys overhead. And then there's a rail hanging on the there, and then the cable trolleys ride on the rail underneath. So the movement of the pipes and the movement of the cables is totally independent. Here's a view of that out by the power crosscut, where your pipes have been pushed on through as the face retreats and pushing the empty rail forward until that rail will remain vacant until the next power move. So then there's a multiple layer monorail, which is nothing new, but once again, you're going more and more hoses, or in some cases, there's a narrow entry. So you got just multiple layers. And in this system here, you got cables and hoses up there, and then these really big water hoses and return hoses down here. That's for a high seam. Here's one for a low seam. But the width of the entry required the double layer. So all these things are ways we can address these demands that we've gone through. Here's another innovation upgraded from the past. It's not new. Use of multiple traction units. It's been in Australia for years, and there's a few places in the States that use it. But you're using a traction unit, breaking your trolleys into groups where you can inch them along and even break pieces apart, move them on out by to help increase your power move. So all these things are, like I said, that's nothing new, but it's enjoying some a rebirth in interest, you might say. That particular unit is that's a battery box there. So that particular unit's for use on the tight side of the belt. You don't want people over there trying to control it, so it's got a radio control. That's pretty nice. So What can we do to address the fact that the pumps are still a long way from the face, or the tailgate especially? Adding the extended length of the face, we're looking at about a half a mile from the pumps to the tail shields. The line losses there can be significant. And of course, that's typically, everybody says, oh, we got bad tail and or head or bad roof in the tail entry. Maybe there's a reason for that. One way to address that situation is to move the pumps closer to the face. Now, this doesn't work everywhere. You got to have some width. But basically, you can put the pumps and the tanks on the monorail. It greatly reduces the line losses, reduces the response time for the pumps, and there's no time consumed in moving the pumps during power moves. I mean, they're already moved. And not only that, you're not breaking the hoses every time you do a power move. So your line or your fluid cleanliness is much better. This shows a pump station with a pump cabinet about 200 feet or 550 meters from the face. That's your section belt. That's your monorail. It's got pipes overhead, and then that's a pump cabinet. It's got sound reducing panels. You got three of them there. Pumps are close to the face, but they're far enough to be out of the activity around the face. And of course, once again, the noise containment's available. Here's on that system, you got three tanks. So your pump return pump goes into a filter, or the face return comes into the filter. So you got the in-tank filters. Those tanks have baffling and so forth and so on. And they are right there with the pumps all the time. So am I all right on time? Okay. Mounting the emulsion and the water filtration near the face is a worthy goal that can be achieved with this system. There's a monorail mounted filter station. Can use backflush filters, automatic backflush, manual backflush, cartridge filters. And the advantage to that is you're getting that filter, that fluid clean right before it goes on the face. So it's a real big advantage there. And once again, this is something that's almost routine in Australia, not quite as common in the States. So there's some cases where the gate entry might be so steep that your back pressure, static pressure from the return, might inhibit the movement of the shield legs. And in such cases, it's been known to put tanks on the stage loader or on the monorail. That way you don't have as much back pressure, and your legs can, your shield props can lower faster. So what do we need to do for the future? And this is very brief. Right now we have a pump system that is sitting there, and it has to sense a pressure drop on the face. Well, by the time that pressure drop is sensed at the pumps, and the pumps load, and then that additional fluid is sent to the face, there's already a time lag of several seconds. Okay? Now, that doesn't seem like much, but if you take a shear that has just double cut the tail, and he's flying down toward the head, and you got 16 shields a minute trying to pull in behind him, those shields are put in a disadvantage because they got to play catch up the whole way down the face, maybe. So what can be done about that? The pumps start at a deficit at this critical point. So the goal is to avoid the initial drop in pressure before the pumps kick in. How can we do that? Whoops, I went too far. The way to do that is, once again, is to have a programmer who's really sharp, and he knows pumps, and he knows shields. And when that command from the control tells the shield to move, it's already told the pumps to load in anticipation. And I think that would be probably the biggest step forward in pumps that people could imagine. So anyway, that's about all I've got. So.
Okay. How about a round of applause for Tom? Pumps starting at a deficit. Sounds like my golf game. Any questions for Tom? Any questions about emulsion systems? In your statistics you gave out during the presentation, we got roughly 50 faces operating in the U.S. How many of those faces would you guess are running VFDs on their emulsion pumping system? Just a wild guess.
Maybe 20%.
20%. Okay. All right. Thank you, Tom.
Okay, thank you.